VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is threatening action if Israeli hostages still held in Gaza are not released before he's sworn into office. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
In a social media post, Trump says if the hostages are not freed by January 20th, there will be all hell to pay in the Middle East. He writes those responsible will be hit harder than anyone has been hit in American history. It's unclear whether Trump's threatening to directly involve the U.S. military in the Israeli campaign against Hamas. Trump allies say he hopes a ceasefire and a hostage release deal is struck before he takes office. The Biden administration has launched a last-ditch effort to try and restart talks between the two sides. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Syrian and Iraqi sources said on Monday that hundreds of fighters from Iran-backed Iraqi militias crossed into Syria overnight to help the government fight rebels who had seized Aleppo last week. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Video on social media purports to show Syrian rebels standing triumphantly atop tanks abandoned by government forces on the outskirts of Aleppo. Their lightning offensive in recent days has threatened territory previously held by the government of President Bashar Assad. Syria's defense ministry on Monday released footage it said showed its troops fighting back around the city of Hama. And Iraqi security sources told Reuters hundreds of Iranian-backed militia fighters crossed into Syria overnight to aid the government. On Monday, the head of the internationally recognized Syrian opposition based in Istanbul said he would not stop fighting until Assad committed to a political process.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Angola on Monday for his long-awaited first presidential visit to sub-Saharan Africa. His three-day visit to the Southern African nation will highlight an ambitious U.S.-backed railway project meant to counter China's influence on the continent of over 1.4 billion people. The White House defended President Biden on Monday over his decision to pardon his son Hunter, even after he said he would not do so. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener has more.
The White House said Biden believed his political opponents would have kept persecuting his son even after he leaves office. A jury in Delaware found Hunter Biden guilty of lying about his drug addiction on a disclosure form that is required to purchase a firearm. In California, he pleaded guilty to criminal charges of failing to pay $1.4 million in taxes while spending lavishly on drugs, sex workers, and luxury items.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Members of the exiled Russian opposition are looking to organize a common strategy while waiting for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump to fulfill his campaign promises to end Russian President Vladimir Putin's war with Ukraine, something they fear could mean a loss of U.S. support. Elizabeth Chernoff narrates this report from Ricardo Marquina.
After nearly 3 years of full-scale war in Ukraine, the Russian opposition to President Vladimir Putin is at a difficult crossroads. With the movement's prominent figures in exile and those left behind forced to remain silent or face imprisonment, the opposition finds itself with no clear leadership. One of Putin's main opponents, Ilya Yashin, welcomes us in Berlin, where he resides after being released from a Russian prison as part of a historic swap in August.
The Russian opposition had a leader, Boris Nemtsov. He was killed. The Russian opposition had another leader, Alexei Navalny. He was arrested and poisoned in prison. Today, there is no current task to join around one person. It seems to me that it is much more important to consolidate around common values.
The transfer of power in Washington next month is cause for concern among Russia's opposition in exile, which is waiting to see whether Donald Trump's pledge to quickly achieve peace in Ukraine will represent a radical change in military and political support for Kyiv. For Ricardo Marquina in Berlin, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. President Joe Biden will meet Angolan President João Lourenço in Luanda today, Tuesday.
His schedule is pretty packed. I was told that he will participate in an official arrival ceremony. He will also have a bilateral meeting, obviously, with his counterpart, President João Lourenço, the Angolan president.
Chad orders French troops' departure and provokes fresh anti-French sentiment. Namibia's ruling SWAPO party rejects opposition calls for a rerun of the November 27 general election. Uganda's military court adjourned on Monday to process the practicing certificate of Kenyan lawyer Martha Karua. Guinea's military junta declares 3 days of national mourning for victims of a soccer stadium stampede.
Barely 24 hours after the incident, the government came up with a report of the statement saying that 56 people died as a result of the stampede and several, according to the statement, were wounded.
And Nigeria's army arrests 17 suspected oil thieves and recovers 1.2 million liters of stolen crude. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Joe Biden will today, Tuesday, meet Angolan President João Lourenço in the capital Luanda and will deliver remarks at the National Slavery Museum. The president arrived in Angola on Monday on the first and only trip to Africa of his presidency. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Mandialo is in the Angolan capital Luanda.
As you know, he made a stop in Cabo Verde where he met the Prime Minister there, Ulysses Correa Silva, where the two leaders discussed, you know, a few issues between the two of them, including democratic freedoms, the growing relationship between the two countries, and also strengthening collaboration to increase climate resilience. And he left there en route to Luanda, and yes, he has arrived there. You can see posters actually in a few places, you know, in the city, showing him shaking hands with the Angolan president just right before he arrived. So I think today, tonight here, he's meeting with the embassy staff, but his schedule tomorrow and Wednesday is pretty packed. I was told that he will participate in an official arrival ceremony. He will also have a bilateral meeting, obviously, with his counterpart, President João Lourenço, the Angolan president. He will also deliver remarks at the National Museum of Slavery. And on Wednesday, that's when he travels to Lobito, where he will tour the Lobito port terminal. But he'll also participate in, the Lobito Corridor Trans-Africa Summit, as we're told.
That's one of the economic benefits of the president's trip. What can you tell us about this Lobito port terminal?
We're told, basically, during his trip to Angola, he will definitely highlight this signature initiative, this investment that the U.S. has made, in the Lobito Corridor, that regional railway project linking obviously natural resource rich areas stretching from the Angola port of Lobito to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia. We know that the corridor is part of a wider joint effort between multiple partners, including the G7 and other African partners. It is aimed at closing what they call the infrastructure gap in growing economies around the world. You know, one White House official actually previewing the president's trip to Angola talked about the fact that the Lobito Corridor isn't just about that railroad and critical minerals, and that it will be about the communities that will be strengthened along the way. For example, he talked about not just critical minerals, but then, you know, about agricultural products.
Mariama, the president's visit fulfills his promise to visit Africa, but some are wondering whether it's a little too late.
Well, that's a very good point, because I spoke to analysts actually about the visit, and a lot of them do commend the fact that he did fulfill a commitment. He did say that he was going to visit Africa 2 years ago at the U.S. Africa Summit in Washington, but he made those promises 2 years ago. Although we've seen a parade of high-level officials visiting Africa, he came, 2 years later, and in those 2 years, a lot has happened. He did run for re-election. He withdrew his candidacy. He endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, who ended up losing the elections. So some people are saying that he should have traveled earlier. The trip would have carried more weight than waiting until basically a few weeks before, you know, the end of his term. You also have other people, other analysts who actually ask the question, why Angola? Why is it the primary destination, given that some human rights organizations, you know, protesters have been kind of concerned about human rights records of the country? Yeah, a mix of reaction from analysts here in Africa.
VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo was speaking with us from the Angolan capital, Luanda. In Namibia, the governing SWAPO party has rejected calls by the opposition for a rerun of the just-ended general election. It comes after a group of opposition political parties called for the cancellation of the presidential and national assembly elections, citing widespread voter irregularities and rigging. Ambassador Kairi Mwende is the campaign manager of SWAPO presidential candidate and the incumbent vice president, Netumbo Nandi-Ndetwa. He tells viewers Peter Clote that the opposition parties have failed to provide proof of their allegations of impropriety during the elections.
There have been problems associated with a shortage of ballot papers. There is the issue of the tablets heating up and, of course, long queues that make it not possible for the voting to be concluded within a day. Voting was extended for another 2 days to allow those who did not vote to do so. But I think what is critical is that the votes allocated to the political party for which it was cast, therefore, and all observers of political parties are present during the voting, the counting of votes, and of course now the announcement of the results. Therefore, I think a credible election will thus be delivered based on those premises. That does not take away the fact that there were technical issues, but those issues do not warrant the rerun of the election, which reflect the wishes of the people.
Well, Ambassador Kairi, the opposition cited instances of voter irregularities and rigging, intimidation and harassment, and they said that undermined the credibility of the elections due to what they said SWAPO's decision to harass an orchestrated attempt to suppress the vote using the power of incumbency and the government to win the election, they said. So they asked for the cancellation.
They have not been able to document instances of intimidation. When people are in a queue, you don't know what political party they belong to. There were long queues. Everybody was affected by the long queues, and everybody was affected by the lack of a better word, maybe mismanagement of the process. But that does not take away the fact that people casted votes in favor of the political party of their choice. But still, there were no cases of intimidation, and they have not documented cases of intimidation.
They are threatening legal action, saying that representatives of the ruling party, SWAPO, colluded with the Electoral Commission to rig the election on your behalf, so there has to be re-election, they argue. How do you respond to that?
I think that is the syndrome of a bad loser, because we have seen the trend so far. But the Electoral Commission is an independent body and therefore completely independent from government and from SWAPO. And SWAPO has been participating in the process of preparing for the election in the same way as all other political parties. And there have never been interference on the side of the government in the electoral process. The police have maintained law and order. There have been no instances of violence. I think this is in bad taste to claim that there was rigging. How can there be rigging when you are there, when the votes are being cast and when they are being counted and when they are being announced?
Ambassador Kairi Mwende is the campaign manager of the SWAPO presidential candidate and the incumbent vice president, Netumbo Nandi-Ndetwa. He spoke with BBC's Peter Clote. The military junta in Guinea-Conakry has declared 3 days of national mourning for victims of a soccer stadium stampede. Provisional reports say at least 56 people have been killed. Reporter Karim Kamara in Conakry tells me that the incident took place Sunday during a soccer tournament in the city of Nzere-Kore, organized in support of junta leader Colonel Mamadi Dumbuya.
The march was going on peacefully and everything at the stadium was festive, and not until the referee accorded a controversial penalty to the host team, Zirikwe. So there then, and the fans of the visiting team of Labi protested. They said, look, they cannot accept this penalty, and they described it as a favored one. So then violence ensued between both supporters. From there then, police decided to use tear gas to disperse the crowd. But what happened? You know, the stadium was full, and according to the report, there was about 10,000 spectators, and most of them were minors. So then they started running helter-skelter, and the stadium is also having just one exit and one entrance.
How many people would you say have been killed or wounded?
The incident took place on Sunday in the evening. Barely 24 hours after the incident, the government came up with a report or a statement saying that 56 people died as a result of the stampede, and several, according to the statement, were wounded. But when I contacted hospital sources in Zirikwe, I was told that more than 100 people were killed. Then several others are still lying down there, some in very critical conditions. So according to the Prime Minister, Bahuri, he says he is shocked, but he says investigations is going on, and in the end, they will keep the population informed after they have finished gathered all necessary information.
What can you tell us about this particular tournament?
Well, it is a tournament hosted in the name of junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya. And this is not the first. It is happening everywhere now, even as we speak. And that we have some happening in Kanka, in Mamu, and in all the regions, you know, in support of junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya. These guys are organizing it because it costs a lot of money, and a lot of money is being dished out to these guys. So this is a campaign, even not directly, but indirectly, you know, at least to gauge the opinion of the youth, whether they like junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya or they don't like it. But it's a way of just trying to make sure that in the end, he says, I am a candidate. It has nothing to do with CAF, neither with FIFA, or neither with even the Guinea National League, but it's just a political one, all in support of junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya.
That's reporter Karim Kamara speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barkley in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December the 3rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye and his co-accused remain in jail on Monday. This after the military court adjourned to process the practicing certificate of Kenyan lawyer Martha Karua. She has been appointed to lead a team of lawyers to defend Dr. Besigye, who, according to his wife, was kidnapped in Kenya and brought back to Uganda. He and his co-accused are charged with unlawful possession of ammunition and a firearm. Karua tells me that she hopes to get a response from the military court by today, Tuesday.
The problem is that the Law Council of Uganda, that is responsible for issuing practicing certificates to advocates, has not yet responded to my application for a special practicing certificate, which will allow me to lead Dr. Kizza Besigye's team. My application was officially received on the 27th, but to date they have not responded. In the morning, I started by going to their offices. They were not there, but I was able to get the telephone number of the chairperson of the Law Council, talked to her on telephone, and she promised that I'll get a response by tomorrow.
Madam, do you think Uganda, being a member of the East African Community, is it necessary to be licensed by individual EAC countries?
Yes, it is still necessary to be licensed, but I have fulfilled all the requirements, and the Law Society of Kenya has written confirming I'm an advocate of the High Court of Kenya, that I have the rank of senior counsel, and that I have a valid practicing certificate. There ought to be no hindrance to the Law Council of Uganda issuing me with a license. Before the adjournment, we were allowed 30 minutes with Dr. Kizza Besigye and also Mr. Lutale, who is his co-accused.
So you were able to see Dr. Besigye. How would you describe his mood?
He's okay insofar as a person under incarceration can be okay. He told me that they are in a prison within the general prison, Luzira, which is a civilian prison. And he confirmed that indeed he was abducted from Kenya by people posing as security. He identified them by language, that they were from Uganda, and as they passed the Kenyan border, which is illegal, and we intend to raise it as a preliminary issue in the military court.
How long do you think it will take to get your accreditation?
The law council's chairperson, she's called Justice Muliangoja. She said they will respond as early as tomorrow.
What do you see, madam, before I let you go? Are there any implications for this particular case for the sub-region, the East African community?
There is serious implications that Kenya and Uganda can join together, behave like the rogue states that they are, abducting the nationals of Uganda, our clients, from Kenya, when they were lawfully there. If they had committed an offense on Kenyan soil, they ought to have been arrested by Kenyan police and arrested in Kenya. If in Uganda, due process extradition proceedings should have been put in motion. Any democratic society cannot go into the territory of another and abduct. And because Kenya has not been annexed by Uganda, Ugandan military or security agencies have no right to enter Kenya to abduct someone. And Kenyan police or security agents have no right to assist in that. So these are matters we are also going to take to the East African Court of Justice and any other forum we deem necessary.
Martha Karua is the leader of a team of lawyers to defend Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. She was speaking with me from Kampala, Uganda. Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby has defended his decision to break military ties with France, saying at a news conference on Sunday that their defense pact no longer meets Chad's security needs. The decision requires France to withdraw its troops from the Central African nation and echoes growing anti-French sentiment with civil society groups who say it is long overdue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
President Mahamat Idriss Deby says that as part of an irreversible move to regain Chad's military sovereignty, he is ending the country's defense cooperation agreement with France. Deby said military ties with France that have existed for close to 65 years are in no way helping to rescue Chad from what he calls growing security challenges, including terrorism and armed conflicts. In a Sunday broadcast on state TV, Deby said his decision to end cooperation agreements with the French military is part of a promise he made during his May 23 inauguration, ending 3 years of military transition. In a message, Deby said he would build reciprocal relations only with friendly nations that respect each other's independence and sovereignty and assist each other in times of crisis. Deby promised to stop ties with countries he said behaved as if Chad had remained their colony. The Central African State first announced that it was ending military ties with France last week. The announcement came after French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot visited Chad and was told that Chad's military is strong enough to protect civilians and their property, according to government officials. Last Friday, the French Foreign Ministry said it had taken note of Chad's decision to end the military agreement with Paris, but gave no further details. Deby's decision has reignited debates on what civil society and opposition groups call France's overbearing influence, provoking tensions in several African countries, especially Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Niger, and Senegal. On Monday, the Consultation Group of Chad's Political Actors, or GCAP, condemned Deby's decision to end military cooperation with France. GCAP spokesperson Max Kemkoye said Chad's military is not strong enough to handle the many security challenges facing the country, he accused Deby of not consulting his government before taking the decision, a claim VOA could not independently verify. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Troops of the Nigerian Army have recovered 1.2 million liters of stolen crude, destroyed 56 illegal refineries, and arrested 17 suspected oil thieves in the Niger Delta. The acting deputy director of 6th Division Army Public Relations, Jonah Danjuma, disclosed this in a statement issued in Port Harcourt on Sunday. Timothy Obiezu reports.
Nigerian military spokesperson Sunday announced the outcome of the latest joint operation by the army and other security agencies between November 25th and December the 1st to halt the theft of crude oil. According to the statement, 17 suspects were arrested, 56 illegal oil bunkering or theft sites were dismantled, and 1.2 million liters of stolen crude was recovered during multiple raids across the Niger Delta. The raids are part of a wider undertaking and renewed efforts to combat oil theft in Nigeria. Energy expert Faith Nwadishi says it is having an impact.
We see that there's been an improvement in production coming from the background of about 2-3 years ago when the Niger Upstream Commission said that we're losing about 70% of our production. These efforts are beginning to yield some results that we are seeing, but I think that more should be done.
Nigeria is one of Africa's top oil producers, but the country has been struggling to curb rampant oil theft for decades. Corruption, poor regulation, and a lack of effective security measures have played a role. The Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, NNPC, estimates the country loses around 200,000 barrels of crude oil per day, or about $10 billion annually, to illegal activities, including oil theft and unauthorized refining operations known as bofire. The term bofire refers to the explosive sound made when crude oil illegally siphoned from official pipelines is heated in a metal cauldron and then condensed into petroleum products. Oil is a major earner for Nigeria's economy. Authorities say oil theft is harming economic growth. Economist Eze Onyebere says the latest crackdown by authorities is welcome, but that the government must focus on organized criminal networks.
Nigeria's crude oil is stolen in a commercial rate. So the expectation is that this should continue and they should go after the real cabals, the people who are doing it at a very bigger level and not just the smaller men and women in the industry.
Nwadishi says Nigerian authorities need to publicly prosecute and convict suspects arrested for oil theft. She says despite authorities often announcing arrests, the prosecution process is usually shrouded in secrecy, giving rise to allegations of manipulation and corruption. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Senegal's Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko on Monday said he would remain head of the government rather than preside over parliament after his party's landslide election win sparked questions over his political role. Some had argued that Sonko should preside over the parliament to avoid any possible conflicts that could arise in an executive where the president owed his position to the prime minister. And that is it for this Tuesday, December the 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington.
Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.